dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this week
you're listening to episode 664 of Unwelcome Guests, the bloodstained laundry of capitalism. I'm Robin Upton, and this week, three angles on capitalism you're not going to hear in commercially controlled media. We begin with Jeff Bailey speaking on accumulation by dispossession. This is a recording from this year that's made available at wearemany.org.
So when I first started preparing this talk, one of the first things I did, because I was curious, was I just did a search of articles and papers that simply had accumulation by dispossession in its title, just in the title. I came up with 3,000. Now, if you figure that the book that David Harvey published that first kind of popularized this idea was written in 2003, that's one a day for 10 years. So, I mean, you get, I mean, it's a kind of statistic, but it gives you, which I'm sure is wrong. but it's clear even just beyond that, even just kind of anecdotally in our own work, it's clear that the ideas of accumulation and dispossession has become very quickly part of the kind of common sense framework of much of the left in understanding neoliberalism. And I think for that reason alone, it's an idea that we need to grapple with. And I do think it's one of the reasons why it's become so popular is that it does capture something of the way we experience capitalism today, and that it does feel as if there's something more primitive and more brutal and more violent about the way capitalism under neoliberalism is stripping the world of resources in search of greater and greater profit. And it really does feel as if we've simultaneously kind of moved into the future and gone back to the past, and that we've kind of entered this period of, like, global multinational robber barons. But when you go through the articles, what's the other thing that's really striking, and then, yes, I did read all 3,000 of my talk, as you go through the articles, the political positions of the articles vary wildly, and sometimes diametrically opposed. Some see neoliberalism as the hijacking of a system by finance capital, while others see it as the logical outgrowth of capital accumulation. Some see the solution as the amelioration of the worst aspects of neoliberalism, while others argue for the revolutionary reconstitution of society. And now, I don't think you can always blame a theory for what people do with it. Right? Marx once famously quipped that he sowed dragons and reaped fleas. but the fact that so many people use this theory for such distinctly different and sometimes diametrically opposed purposes also suggests that we need to approach it critically and try to clarify what we mean by it, and I think there's some important criticisms to be raised of it. Now I'm going to assume, if you're here, given how uncatchy the title was, that you know something about the concept of accumulation by dispossession. But very briefly, for those for who this is new, accumulation by dispossession is a term that's been popularized by the Marxist writer David Harvey to describe the ways that neoliberal capitalism uses force and theft really to rob the world, both people and nature, of value in its quest for endless profit. And I'll explain a little bit more what he means by it, but it's really an extension of Marx's writings on primitive accumulation, which I'll also take a little time to explain, in which Harvey argues that alongside the exploitation of workers and the extraction of surplus value, that Marx saw as the central driving force and the central source of profits under capitalism, that there's also simple plunder and theft. The simple transfer of wealth using a number of different mechanisms from the world's working class and poor and nature itself to the ruling class. And it's also part of a long-standing critique of Marx's work that he confined the discussion of theft and plunder to the prehistory and the early days of capitalism, and didn't take into enough account the continuing role it plays in the modern world. And Harvey goes on to, oh my god, I'm literally shivering.
It's freezing.
He argues, Harvey then goes on to argue that understanding the dynamics of dispossession is crucial to understanding the dynamics of neoliberalism. And so before we get to Harvey, I want to look at what Marx himself wrote, and then very, very briefly and schematically look at some of the critiques that were made between Marx and Harvey's writings. Because I think by doing that we can get a better understanding of where Harvey's arguments fit and what our critiques are. So some of Marx's most angry, vivid, graphic writings come at the end of Capital, Volume 1. That after several hundred pages of difficult, often dense writings on political economy, you come to a final section in which Marx describes the origins of capitalism. And he starts by describing it this way. He says, in the tender annals of political economy, as in the books written by the apologists for the system, the idyllic reigns from time immemorial. But in actual history, it's notorious that conquest, enslavement, robbery, murder, briefly force, played the great part. And what Marx is doing is refuting the ideas of Adam Smith, who was one of the first writers to write about what he called original accumulation, in which Smith writes about a kind of capitalist grasshopper in the ant story, which is the way capitalism emerges is that you have some people who save up their crumbs while other people are off playing in the fields, and those people one day realize that they don't have anything to invest in factories and they therefore have to go work for the people who sat around saving their pennies. And instead, that's actually the language he uses. Instead of the quaint image of the distinguished gentleman saving his pennies to invest in factories, Marx gives us this history. He says, the discovery of gold and silver in America, the extirpation, enslavement, and entombment in mines of the aboriginal population, the beginning of the conquest and looting of the East Indies, the turning of Africa into a warren for the commercial hunting of black skins signalized, and he's being sarcastic here, the rosy dawn of the era of capitalist production. These idyllic proceedings are the chief moments of primitive accumulation, that it was their genocide, not their thrifty disposition, that allowed early capitalists to begin to invest. And it was not their savings, but their savagery that created the initial conditions that allowed for the expansion of capitalist production. It was through slavery, murder, and genocide that early capitalists gathered the initial wealth that was then turned into capital. But turning that wealth into capital also required another change. And a large part of the section is Marx really trying to show that capitalism is not a natural condition. No matter how many times pundits and apologists try to explain capitalism as the outgrowth of our biology or natural inclinations, in fact, there's nothing natural about the idea of going to work for 8, 10, 12, 14 hours a day for someone else. That as long as people owned their own land and were reasonably self-sufficient, they felt no compulsion to go to work for the capitalists. You know, you're working on your farm, raising your carrots and goats or whatever, and somebody comes up to you and says, hey, I have an idea. Come work for me in my hellish factory for 14 hours a day. Awesome! Right? And in fact, that's what the response was in many places. Ending self-sufficiency was what forced peasants into the workshops and created a market for finished goods. Peasants who owned their own land had to be driven off those lands, and commonly held lands had to be broken up and sold. And in particular, and this is what becomes important for Harvey, in order for that to happen, force was needed. Prior to the establishment of the market, the economic compulsion that we experience under a fully formed capitalist system doesn't work. Because if peasant families aren't integrated into the market, that is, if they're only producing for their own needs and wants, you can't use the compulsion of needing to sell goods for cash to begin to draw people into the market. So in its essence, primitive accumulation is the use of political and the use of force, of physical force, to privatize the means of production so that capitalists can exploit workers who have no other choice but to work for them. But once capitalist relations are dominant, new compulsions emerge. The market provides its own silent compulsion. For workers, either work or starve, and for capitalists, accumulate or be driven under by those who do. So as Marx notes at the end of the section, he's quoting the French poet Augier, If money comes into the world with a congenital blood stain on one cheek, then capital comes dripping from head to foot from every pore with dirt and blood. Now, Rosa Luxemburg is really the first theorist to revisit Marx on this question. And she criticizes Marx for treating primitive accumulation as something that's a solely historical phenomenon. So in Accumulation of Capital, she writes, "Admittedly, Marx dealt in detail with the process of appropriating non-capitalist means of production, as well as the transformation of the peasants into capitalist proletariat. Yet for Marx, these processes are incidental, illustrating merely the genesis of capital, its first appearance into the world. As soon as he comes to analyze the capitalist process of production and circulation, he reaffirms the universal and exclusive domination of capitalist production." And she argues that the appropriation of what she calls the non-capitalist means of production isn't something that's relegated to the past, but an ongoing part of capitalism. That theft and plunder isn't something that happened only at the rosy dawn, but is an ongoing process. I can't do justice to Luxemburg's theory. She's really trying to explain the origins of imperialism. But I do want to focus just on the parts that relate to the discussion of primitive accumulation. Because what she says is that Marx made a mistake. Basically, that capital always produces more stuff than it pays out in wages to workers. That surplus value exists because workers are forced to produce more than they're paid out in wages. And her question is then, who buys that surplus? Because at some point, that surplus needs to be bought, converted into money, so that it can be reinvested and start a new cycle of expanded reproduction. And she argues that continued expansion of capitalism is impossible without the continual conquering of areas that are outside capitalism, and that the plunder of the colonies was a means of extracting new wealth and creating a market for that excess surplus. So it's an ongoing process. And I'm not going to go into it. There's been a lot of people who've written, I think, to show that the foundation of Luxemburg's theories are flawed, that in fact the continuing expansion of the system can provide the possibility for the absorption of that surplus, although crisis can also interrupt that process. But the important thing for us is her argument that what enables capitalism to continue to expand is only the continuing theft and destruction of things outside of itself. And that argument gets picked up in some ways in the 1960s and 70s as a way to try to understand the continued underdevelopment of countries in the global south and what becomes known as dependency theory. So like Luxemburg, they criticize Marx for treating primitive accumulation as something that only happened in the past. So the Egyptian Marxist Samir Amin writes, "The mechanisms of primitive accumulation do not belong only to the prehistory of capitalism. They're contemporary as well. It's these forms of primitive accumulation, modified but persistent, to the advantage of the center, so the global north, that form the domain of the theory of accumulation on a world scale. That plunder and theft of the global south," he argues, "is something that's ongoing and helps account for the continued disparity between north and south." And on one level, there's some truth to this argument, which is the sense that plunder and theft are always part of capitalism. But there's a number of reasons, I think, to be very critical of these theories. First is that it can be shown fairly clearly that the main flows of capital, even in Luxemburg's times, were not from the south to the north, but mainly within the industrialized countries of the north. To be sure, capitalism then, as now, has never been above destroying and plundering entire countries for its own benefit. I mean, you only have to read the histories of what happened in the Belgian Congo to see that this is not something that only happens in the past. But it was never central to capitalist expansion. The real profit and real focus of the system remained the exploitation of workers at home. But the other thing I think they miss is something that was always central to Marx's analysis of capitalism. That although capitalism was accompanied by horrific violence, it was also a dynamic system. That the description of capitalism you get from reading Luxemburg and some of the dependency theories is really kind of a decrepit, sclerotic system that only keeps itself alive by siphoning wealth off of other parts of the world and when I always read it, the image that always comes to mind for me is the image of a zombie. You know, sort of like this undead creature that only can survive by feeding off of the brains of the living. And Marx had a more dynamic view of capitalism. He insisted that despite its tendency to inequality and crisis, capitalism is driven forward by the need to accumulate. It's precisely its drive to conquer the globe, exploit every market, and exploit every human everywhere on the planet to mine the very planet itself that leads to new contradictions and crises. that violence and war are products not of capitalism's inability to reproduce itself, but a consequence of its very success in doing that. It's not that Marx was completely unaware that fraud and plunder were continued under capitalism, but he insisted that capitalism couldn't be, as earlier writers had done, reduced to it. The discussion of plunder is partly not in Capital, because Capital is a critique of political economy. It's not, especially in the first volume, a full description of the way capitalism works. It's an attempt to show that if we accept the preconditions of the neoliberals, the liberals of his time, that we have free markets, only workers and capitalists, and that all commodities are purchased at their full value, the result is not trickle-down wealth of nations, but instead greater inequality, poverty, and misery for the majority, while a tiny minority reap billions. What Marx was trying to show was that even without theft, exploitation is what is at the heart and what drives the capitalist system. So that, of course, capitalism produces its Madoffs, its Enrons, but it can't be reduced to them. And so where does Harvey then begin to fit into this? First, Harvey does reject Luxembourg's insistence that expanded reproduction, the continuing expansion of capitalism, is impossible. He rejects that. He does see a relationship between accumulation by dispossession and expanded reproduction. But he argues that dispossession, which had always been present in capitalism, becomes increasingly significant during the long period of economic crisis from the 1970s to today, and that faced with a crisis of profitability, with a crisis in its ability to generate profit through the exploitation of labor, that capitalism has tried to solve that crisis by increasingly turning towards fraud, plunder, and predation. And then he goes on to list a whole kind of dizzying array of mechanisms that it uses to do that. And just so people are clear, because when I first read Harvey, I was a little confused by this, he's mainly not focusing on the process of the transformation of peasants into workers, which is really the center of Marx's theory of primitive accumulation. He's drawing much more on other sections of those writings where we're talking about the kind of theft and plunder of the world and the transfer of value from one section of the world to the other. So he goes on and he lists a whole series of ways that capitalism under neoliberalism, he believes, does this. So he lists the privatization of what used to be public services into profit-making enterprises, the privatization of water, education, healthcare, and in some parts of the world, particularly Eastern Europe, the selling off of the economies of entire nations to private business. He lists the use of the international credit system, especially the IMF and World Bank, as a means of forcefully transferring wealth from the south to the north, the pushing of peasants off their lands and the creation of mega slums, and the use of intellectual property rights to commodify what was once common knowledge, and uses the example of Terminator seeds, which people may know, the genetically modified seeds that you can't gather the seeds from the plants to plant the following year. The problem with this is that it lumps together really what are a number of different processes, some of which are very intimately tied to the question of exploitation of labor and the expanded reproduction of capital. Because remember, what Marx was trying to distinguish was between the violence and plunder that has existed through all class societies and the particular dynamics and the way in which capitalism transforms theft and plunder that are really specific to capitalism. The fact that those things are sometimes intertwined in real life is all the more reason to try to separate them out in theory. So take the Terminator seeds, for instance. Terminator seeds are not generally introduced at the point of a gun. They don't have to be because peasants are often, if not always completely, integrated into the market, producing goods that then need to be sold on the market. And they can be pressured by market prices into growing certain crops and not others, and agribusiness exploits this to create new markets. But that in and of itself doesn't require a new theory. Mm-hmm. It was part of the basic drive to accumulate that Marx writes about from the very early days, even in the Communist Manifesto. So he writes, "The need of a constantly expanding market for its products chases the bourgeoisie over the entire surface of the globe, and in place of old wants satisfied by the productions of the country, we find new wants requiring for their satisfaction the products of distant lands and climes." This is centrally rooted to the basic dynamics of capitalist accumulation. Harvey points to Enron and its liquidation of its employees' pensions and the closing of unprofitable factories as examples of accumulation by dispossession. but the closure of unprofitable businesses as a means of restoring profitability is a central part of Marx's theory of crisis. It's not separate from the creation of surplus value. It's how capital reestablishes profitability and opens up the possibility for a new round of expansion. A big part of his work deals with privatization. But privatization isn't primarily, although it often does this, about transferring wealth from the poor to the rich. It's largely about transferring wealth and value from one section of capital to another.
Right.
So take what's become really the classic kind of example of accumulation by dispossession, the water wars in Cochabamba, Bolivia. As people know, Bechtel, California company, comes in, privatizes the water, leading to massive spikes and increase in massive profits for Bechtel and a massive war that eventually defeats them. Not war, struggle, you know. Some places. Sometimes it felt like a war. But prior to that, it's not like we're talking about a country where water was commonly held by the people. It was controlled by a state monopoly that was very much subject to the pressures of the market and diverted water resources towards industrial development in wealthier neighborhoods, and the poor were left to buy water from a series of small commodity traders.
Rainwater was probably going to...
What's that?
Rainwater.
I was going to say that, yes. But again, there were examples. So in the absence of that, people found ways to collect rainwater, and people, there were stopgap measures. So again, it's not that there's never any aspect of dispossession happening, but more that it's wrapped up and tied to the very basic foundations or dynamics of capitalism. And even when describing what seems to be closest to what Marx is talking about, the forcing of peasants off their lands, we have to be careful not to lump everything together. That in many places where force is used to dislocate peasant families, but in many instances, those families are not fully self-sufficient peasants.
Yeah.
Many people are already at least partially integrated into the market. And while the use of force is an accompanying factor, they're also responding to market pressures. I mean, Robert Brenner's written talking about this, the beating out by agribusiness of individual farmers who have already been living and dying by the whims of the market is an all too familiar aspect of capitalist competition. It leads to social misery, but it's very much part of capitalist expansion. And there's a couple of dangers here, which is that I think by taking all of these things and kind of lumping them together and by separating them off from the central dynamic of production and the extraction of surplus value, it can seem as if these things are not integral to the dynamics of the system, and that they're kind of peripheral excesses. Now, this is not what Harvey's saying. I think Harvey constantly is trying to talk about the connections between the two, but it is certainly how the theory can be interpreted, and I think the way the theory is framed leaves it open to that. Second, and more importantly, by including all of these different aspects of capitalism under the label of accumulation by dispossession, is what enables Harvey to make the dubious claim that accumulation by dispossession has become the dominant form of accumulation relative to expanded reproduction. And here, and this is why I kind of went through that, maybe what felt at the time like a slight detour through Luxembourg and the dependency theories, because what we've come back to is a view of capitalism that's no longer able to expand on its own terms, and that can only exist, or at least in Harvey's writings, largely exist by siphoning wealth off of other sections of the globe. The first objection to this is that, like with Luxembourg, it's hard to understand how this can be the main drive of capitalism, because even where it's true, we're not talking about the creation of new wealth or new value. We're talking about the transfer of wealth within the system, and that can lead to incredible misery and horrors that need to be fought against. But it's a zero-sum game. You're stealing from some capitalists to enrich others. It doesn't explain the forward motion of the system. And that forward motion is important, because I think seeing the system as a static one, or at least a sort of sclerotic one, is untenable now. After looking at the transformations of the last 30 years, that you only have to look at China and India and Brazil to see that there's been a profound transformation of capitalism and a real expansion, not only at its core, but in the global south as well. And all of this may seem, I hope not, but it may seem like splitting hairs. But I think that it has implications for how we understand who has the power to change the system. Because the arguments about primitive accumulation have always been tied up, and what you see as the central dynamic of the system has always been tied up in then who has the power to change it. So for dependency theorists, for instance, the argument that the main axis of capitalism was a transfer of wealth from the south to the north was part of a move away from the idea that worker struggle internationally was the main force that would overthrow capitalism. Now, Harvey, to his credit, continues to defend the role played by workers at the point of production. He insists that the struggles against dispossession need to be tied to the struggles of workers at the point of production, which he calls expanded reproduction. But I think in his writings, Harvey seems to present too much of a distinction between these two worlds. By painting too broad a picture of what we mean by dispossession, he then paints too narrow a picture of what we mean by working class struggle at the point of production. And I have to say, I don't think I've seen where he's fully fleshed this out, but just in reading it, the sense I get is that worker struggle gets limited to the struggles over wages and benefits and working conditions. Glad. So you guys agree? Thank you. So it appears that you have fights against dispossession on one side and fights at the point of production on the other side, and that somehow this chasm needs to be joined, when in reality these fights are much more closely linked. There's no doubt that we are witnessing the largest restructuring of the world's working class in generations, if not ever. But it hasn't led to the often proclaimed end of the working class. Instead, what we're seeing is sections of the working class that for generations, internationally, were the strongest, best organized sections of the working class have been decimated, have come under 30 years of sustained attack. And in places where production is being expanded and the working class is growing fastest is most often in regions where working class organization is at its weakest. And so it seems to me that one of the challenges, and this is why I have criticisms of the theory of dispossession, is that by separating this thing off, it's silent on, to me, what I think is one of the main challenges for Marxism and Marxists today, is to understand the concrete ways in which expansion and underdevelopment not only coexist, but combine with one another today. So I really encourage people, if you haven't read it, to read Paul Mason's Live Working or Die Fighting. He gives a very first-hand account of what this process looks like around the world. Let me go a little bit longer. He describes, and I'll just talk about one chapter of it, he describes the Nigerian slum of Amukoko, which is one of Lagos' larger slums. It has a population of 15 million people with poverty rates of nearly 50%. But what he describes is you walk 2 miles outside of Amukoko and you find the industrial heart of Lagos, with brand new factories by Guinness, Dunlop, and Nigerian Steel and Wire. And when the mass protest movement, Occupy Nigeria, broke out in 2012, what you saw was a mass movement of the urban poor organized around the strikes and workers' organizations of the Nigerian working class. So dispossession isn't something separate, but that's part of and wrapped up in the process of expansion and exploitation. And the struggles against them are not separate spheres, but need to be joined because those struggles are deeply interlinked. And this doesn't mean that every struggle in every country then emerges in the same way, that each country is going to have its own balance of forces and combinations. So you can think you have places on one extreme, like Afghanistan, where whatever small working class may have once existed is gone. And there you look at, and I do think you can make a case that the dominant process is simple extraction. But in some ways, Afghanistan may be the exception that proves the rule, because in many other places you have situations where, like in Bolivia or Zimbabwe, where you have countries with a long tradition of militant working class struggle that have been decimated, have the ranks decimated by neoliberalism. So you have mass unemployment, but still this tradition of working class struggle. And you can see, for instance, in Zimbabwe, when the mass protests broke out in that country a few years ago, the working class centers, even though they were decimated by unemployment, were able to provide an organizing center for a larger movement of the urban poor. From there, you also have countries like Egypt, South Africa, Brazil, countries that combine massive unemployment and poverty with huge working classes that maintain tremendous strength and militance. And then you have places like India and China and large parts of Southeast Asia where you're seeing the creation of a massive new working class, but in areas with a very weak tradition, India less so, but a weak traditions and organizations of workers. But in all these examples, it seems to me that what's most important is to understand both the profound ways capitalism's restructured in the last 30 years, but also what's remained the same. That while it's true that dispossession is a constant feature of capitalism, it has not become the dominant feature. That production and the exploitation of workers to create surplus value remains at the heart of the capitalist system, and the working class remains central to the struggle against it. Now, we at the Left Forum, we had a chance to talk with Marcela Oliveira, who's one of the leaders of the struggle in Cochabamba, and we were talking about something related to this, and she made the point that we have to get out of the binary idea of the proletariat on one side and capitalists on the other. And I think that there's, in some ways, it's a bit of a straw man.
Yeah.
Because that was never Marx's understanding of class struggle, but rather a product, where it did exist, a product of Stalinism and the development of a certain type of politics in the workers' movement. But that to insist on the centrality of the working class is not to denigrate other struggles of the oppressed or against other forms of capitalist dispossession. It's merely to insist that the working class continues to have a unique position in society. That you can disrupt the system in many ways. You can shut down the highways, you can have the blockades, but at a certain point, you need to take over. That at a certain point, oppressed classes must go beyond disrupting the system of production and take control of it. At a certain point, you can no longer blockade the roads. You need to run the trucks that are running on them. You can't just occupy the squares. You have to occupy and restart the factories, the schools, the offices, the fields. And there's a long tradition, and I'll wrap up on this, there's a long tradition of attempts by Marxists to try to figure out how to do this. How do you place working class struggle at the center of a wider, larger struggle of oppressed and exploited classes? And think of Lenin's writings on Russia and the peasantry. Gramsci's attempts to work out a strategy to build unity between the workers in the north of Italy and peasants and the less industrial, underdeveloped sections of southern Italy, to the work of M.M. Roy in India. How exactly you begin to fuse the struggles of the oppressed with workplace struggles can't be determined in a meeting or in a book. Right? Those things get worked out in the streets. They're being worked out in Egypt today, in Bolivia, in the struggles in China, and the struggles here in the United States. But it's through those struggles that we begin to find a new language that allows us to connect these lessons of the past with the struggles of today and the process of rebuilding a new socialist workers' movement that can both look to the power of the working class, but be at the center of a much wider struggle against oppression and exploitation.
And the next piece is from Against the Grain in 2011. Sasha Lilly is interviewing David Graeber about his book, Debt, the First 5,000 Years.
David, why is the notion that people must pay the financial debts they accrue so deeply ingrained in our society?
It's a really interesting question, and one of the reasons I wrote the book was because it somewhat mystified me. One of the things that really impressed me was the degree to which the argument, you know, people have to pay their debts, could be used to justify things that just could never have been justified in any other way. Particularly when I was involved in the global justice movement, we were doing campaigns about third world debt, and we could tell stories about poor people whose lives were completely destroyed, dying babies, and the things that people would otherwise consider an atrocity. And even very liberal-minded people would say, well, that's terrible, but I mean, surely you're not saying people aren't going to pay their debts. I mean, they borrowed the money. So that was really the problem I was trying to solve. And what I ended up concluding is that there's been a very, very long and deep process that has gone on for thousands of years whereby our basic notions of morality and what it is to have a moral obligation, what it is to make a promise, have been kind of caught up in this financial logic, have been so corrupted by it that we can't tell the two apart.
I guess really the question that needs to be asked first is, what is wrong with the notion that, because it's kind of a common sense notion, that if you take out a debt, you should pay it? Why not?
Well, I mean, on one level, it makes obvious common sense because a debt is just a promise. Now, if I make a promise to someone, I mean, it is a solemn commitment, and if people paid no attention to their promises, well, the world would be a very horrible place. On the other hand, a debt is a very particular type of promise. And the problem is that we've come to imagine all promises as if they were debts. But a debt is not just a promise. A debt is a promise that has become turned into mathematics, something. And once it has been turned into mathematics, you can precisely quantify what someone owes, it becomes impersonal. It becomes detached from the quality of the relationship of the people who have made promises to one another. And as a result of that, it becomes detachable so that, like, if I make a promise to you, you can't turn that promise over to a third party. With a debt, because it's impersonal, you can. So it's when you get morality caught up in that, that kind of mathematical logic, that terrible things can start to happen, obviously, particularly when you add interest to that. And what I discovered is that it's not a natural transformation. It's not like there's something about the nature of promises that makes us want to turn them into math. Quite the opposite. That forcing promises into that kind of mold where it seems that, you know, debts and obligations and promises are all just kind of the same thing really only happens through the medium of violence. Historically, it's always been in context of either potential violence or violence that that leap can be made.
What do you mean by that? Give us an example, perhaps.
Okay. Well, one of the great mysteries that have plagued historians, economists for a long time has been the origins of money. One of the things that I discovered in my research is not only that, as an anthropologist, we've always known that there's something wrong with the conventional account. You know, once upon a time there was barter, and then barter proving inconvenient, people had to invent money as a kind of medium of exchange, and gradually credit systems come out of that. Now, we always known that was wrong because we've never actually been able to find any place in the world where people use barter for everyday transactions. However, what I discovered is it's kind of, it's not just wrong, it's backwards. Credit systems come thousands of years before you have actual cash, at least in the sense of coinage. And barter, when it does occur, usually happens when money systems had existed and they break down, say in Russia in the 90s. All right, so the problem isn't how do you go from this inconvenient form of exchange barter to the invention of money. How do you go from credit systems to the invention of money? Well, you're talking exactly what I said. How do you go from a promise? And, you know, in most organic communities where people know their neighbors, that's the way things work. If you wouldn't trade with your neighbor by swapping things, like economists fantasize. You know, they have something you need, you ask them for a favor. A lot of parts of the world, all you have to do is praise somebody else's possession, and they'll immediately give it to you. And they'll pretend it's just a gift, but of course, you owe them a favor. So everybody owes each other favors, and these favors are broad. I contributed a cow to your sister's wedding, you'll contribute a cow to mine, or something sort of like that, something vaguely equivalent to a cow. How does that turn into numbers? Because once you have money, you have to be able to quantify how many chickens equals one cow, how many silver plates equals one beaver pelt. Now, that's the great question, quantification. And that's exactly the problem I'm looking at. How do you go from moral obligations to numbers that can be transferred to one another, from one person to another? Well, the answer is, if, say, I want your cow and for something, and I praise your cow, you'll give me the cow, or, and say you give me something back that's completely inadequate, three chickens. You know, I might say that you're a cheapskate and mock you, which is kind of a terrible thing to do in a small community, being mocked like that. Might hurt your feelings a lot, but, you know, I'm not going to come up with a formula for exactly how cheap I think you are, right? On the other hand, if, say, I mock you, you get mad at me, we're all drunk, and we end up in a fight, and my eye gets poked out. Well, that's where, in societies without systems of money, you do tend to get exact, because there are often these very detailed codes of, you know, for this type of injury, you pay 27 heifers. I mean, if you don't have heifers, what do you substitute? And that's when people are very likely to be exacting, as it were. You know, 27 heifers or this means war. In situations where there has been violence, where there's potential for a feud. And in fact, that's what you get. I was very impressed by the Welsh and Irish early medieval law codes, where they actually had a money price attached to every single object that would likely be in someone's house, from the rafters to the silverware. Even though, actually, there were no markets where you could buy those things. Nobody ever bought or sold them. They just used, but they had to substitute things. You had to pay a fine. Somebody insulted someone, injured someone. So that's one context where it's violence. Another context has simply has to do with war and slavery. there's very often very complicated systems of money that are used to rearrange personal relations. In many societies, money is never used to buy things, but it is used to arrange weddings, pay people for favors, ritual sponsorship or something like that. Now, again, those circumstances, you might be transacting in people, but you're not buying and selling them. But once war comes in, slavery, to tear people out of those social contexts in which they're normally rested, suddenly people actually become commodities. And some of the earliest forms of money, the earliest denominations of money, actually seem to have been slaves.
You started talking about how there is a notion within, well, within mainstream economics about the origins of money, which are actually quite inaccurate, that don't have a basis in any empirical evidence, particularly around the notion of money being created to replace economies of barter, which is an idea found in Adam Smith's The Wealth of Nations. Given how erroneous it is, why does the profession of economics hold on to it? What's its significance?
That's another thing I spent a lot of time thinking about, because it is incredibly stubborn. Adam Smith assumed that all societies which don't actually have money would operate by barter, direct swapping of things back and forth between neighbors. In fact, anthropologists have discovered that rather than 100% of societies without money being like that, 0% were. We haven't found a single one. Yet economists keep telling the story. If you open up an economics textbook, well, they used to say primitive people use barter. They can't say that anymore because it's been disproved so many times. So now they sort of say, imagine you didn't have money. What would you have to do? So they tell these little fairy tales. There seems to be this need to do so. Now, if you look at what actually happens, it becomes quickly obvious that a lot of the point of this fairy tale is to sort of map out the field of economics as if it has always existed, which is a bunch of people swapping things. And if you ask economists, actually, they'll often say, well, all economies are really barter economies. Money is just this sort of tool that we use to facilitate barter. I actually found a couple telling examples for the book of how barter between strangers actually takes place, because neighbors don't engage in barter, but people do sometimes barter with strangers. And it's the last thing on people's minds is getting the best possible deal between chickens and cows. In fact, if you meet up with strangers, it's either because they're people that you don't really know, don't trust, and there's incredible tension, there's possibility of war, but there's also sexual intrigue, you know? I mean, because, you know, imagine you're living in a society where there's only about 20, 30 people of around the same age and of the opposite sex that you actually know. Meeting up with strangers is very exciting. There's immediate affairs, people have fights, sometimes people kill each other and then remarry. There's all sorts of things going on. In some parts of Australia, for example, they actually turn barter into this ritualized orgy where, like, the women of one side attack the men, drag them off to the bushes, they have sex, they give them some cloth, the other ones come back and give them something else. It's about anything but, you know, a bunch of people sort of rationally thinking about how to get the most chickens for themselves. Now, this is precisely what I think reveals what the economists are doing. It's only when you create markets and cash that you have completely impersonal relations with each other, where you can just not think at all about the person you're dealing with and only think about how to get as many objects as possible for yourself to get the best deal. What economists are basically doing is taking that kind of what they call rationality, and what they think is the basis of human nature. And some of them, like the Austrians, actually make a great point of this. This is what people basically are. Others are a little less explicit. But they project it backwards as the cause of the very institutions that create that sort of behavior. It's almost like saying that the game of chess was invented because people have some natural desire to checkmate one another's king, so therefore you invented chess. So, in a way, I think the ultimate purpose they have is to run away from what the real role of economics is. Economics claims to be an empirical science that studies human behavior, thus all the equations, and a lot of their authority comes from claiming to be a science. Now, therefore, that story is very important because it sort of maps out the ground for the science in advance. However, you know, if they were really a science and they make constantly non-predictive predictions, you know, if they constantly say this is how people behave, it's wrong, you'd think they would adjust their hypotheses. That's what actual scientists do. In fact, what economists are doing is the work of what markets have been doing for centuries, which is teaching people to behave in certain ways. In order to be able to do so, they have to some degree, deny that's what they're doing and claim to be a science. So they're caught in the circular loop.
So it seems that one of the elements that is being obfuscated in some way by mainstream economics making this parallel or basically presuming that the economic system that we live under is really just a system of barter is to make the sphere of production and exchange seem like some independent entity that is off doing its own thing separated from the state. And you argue that actually this is really erroneous. And of course, this division between markets and the state is not one that's just posited by mainstream economics, but actually often the left gets very caught up in seeing the markets and the state as somehow polar opposites to each other. So why are they not?
Well, exactly. I think ever since probably the early 19th century, all the great political debates have been, free market versus social welfare state. And the argument has always been that these are essentially opposed principles. You have state bureaucracy, according to libertarians, is ultimately based on coercion and violence, and this goes back to Herbert Spencer, at least, in the 1830s and 40s. Or you have the market, which is the land of contract, and freely contracting individuals for good or for ill. Now, the remarkable thing, again, is that all historical evidence shows that these are not dichotomous principles that exist apart from one another, but that they only exist in relation to one another. If you find societies that don't have states, almost invariably they don't have impersonal markets of the sort that are always assumed to be opposed to them. And there's every reason to believe that markets, in the sense of markets operating on cash, impersonal markets, really are a product of states, and specifically a side effect of state military operations. If you look at the invention of coinage, it happens near simultaneously, not quite simultaneously, in the Aegean, on the Eastern Mediterranean, spreads quickly through the Mediterranean. It happens in northern India, and it happens in northern China, all around the same time. Apparently not influenced by each other. They're using different actual physical techniques to make the coins. Now, what are these coins used for? In almost every case, they seem to be used primarily to pay soldiers. And the more large empires spread, the more the use of coinage spreads. Empires go away, beginning of the Middle Ages, the coins disappear too. So what's going on? Well, it seems that the key factor here is taxation. It's always been a little bit of a mystery, if you accept sort of Adam Smith version of where money comes from. People barter with each other, it becomes inconvenient, they sort of spontaneously have to invent some kind of currency. Well, if that were the case, why did ancient kings demand taxes and money? It might seem obvious they want the money, but if gold and silver just sort of naturally became money, wouldn't the obvious thing to do be to just grab the gold and silver mines? And in fact, ancient kings generally did just that. They grabbed the gold and silver mines. So if the king already controls the gold and silver mines, he's got all the money he wants, what's the point of taking it, stamping your picture on it, giving it to people, and then saying, okay, everybody give it back again? Well, the only logical explanation is they're actually trying to create markets. The big problem, if you're an ancient king, is how to feed your soldiers. Because say you have an army, 50,000 people, say. Well, they're going to eat pretty much everything there is to eat in the vicinity of where they are within a matter of weeks. Either you're going to have to get 50,000 more people just to get food to them somehow, or you're going to have to figure out some way to get everybody else to supply them with food. Well, the easiest way to do that is to take gold and silver, which is, of course, the kind of thing that soldiers are going to have little bits of anyway if they've been looting and pillaging. Systematize it by taking it, stamping your picture on it, giving it to them, and then saying, all right, everybody in the kingdom now has to give me one of these back again. Suddenly, you've just employed all of your population as soldier feeders, or giving soldiers things they want, people. Now, markets crop up right next to military camps, and it happens over and over again. Someone did a study of the distribution of coinage in the Roman Empire and discovered almost all the coins they found are either in Italy itself, where a lot of the legions were stationed, or on the border where the armies were. Where there were no soldiers, people didn't even really use Roman coins very much. So this pattern appears over and over again. Actual physical coinage tends to be a product of wars, empires, and governments. Governments create markets through intentional policies. They did the same thing in much of the Third World. The colonial empires created by England, France, U.S., Belgium, and so forth. In almost every case, the first thing they did when they conquered a place was print money and then demand that everybody give it to them in taxes. It was a way of creating market.
You write in Debt, the First 5,000 Years, that human history has been, or at least known history, has been the history of two forms of money, virtual money and bullion. And you were just describing bullion. Perhaps you can tell us a bit more what virtual money looked like in societies that were not based around things like credit cards, such as in Mesopotamia or in the Middle Ages, and then explain why this transition between these two forms.
Sure. Again, we tend to think that virtual credit money, the kind of money we use in everyday transactions, is something new. Sort of entering in this kind of brave new science fiction world where money takes this immaterial form. In fact, one of the really startling things I discovered in my historical survey is, first of all, that credit money is the original form of money. Second of all, that there are cycles of history whereby some periods are dominated by virtual credit money. Other periods, people are actually using physical gold, silver, coins in everyday transactions. But even more strikingly, that the pattern of change seems quite uniform all the way across Eurasia. There really was one single kind of field of transformation. The same things keep happening in China, India, and the Middle East, and by extension Europe, over and over again. Now, credit money in Mesopotamia, as I say, its original form, seems to come out of the administration of temples. A shekel, which is originally a weight of silver, which corresponds to a certain amount of grain, actually corresponds to a ration system, the amount that it would take to feed one temple worker two meals a day for a month. Now, at some point, and it seems to happen before our first written records, everybody starts using this administrative accounting system of how to keep track of grain, various products that are used in temples when they're doing exchange with one another. We don't know how it happened, but what we do know is they were using some kind of system of account, because even though when people sold things to each other, they were using silver to keep track of how much things cost, they didn't actually make scales small, fine enough. They actually had the technical capacity, but they didn't choose to make scales fine enough to weigh out the tiny amounts of silver that it would have taken to buy a hammer or a tunic or some everyday item like that. Instead, people seem to have just kept track of who owed what to whom. And there were various, if you were a merchant, there were these complicated documents called billets that sort of were like almost like letters of exchange that could circulate around. They were circulating IOUs, basically. But, say you go into the bar in ancient Sumer, well, you have a tab. It's not an unfamiliar idea. People keep track of how much you owe. They notch some tablet of some kind, maybe a stick. And around harvest time, or some period where people would likely be flush of money or stuff, you bring something in of the value of what you owe. And you can negotiate what? Usually it's grain, but sometimes they'll take other stuff too. Similarly, there are expense accounts. So we already have rather sophisticated credit systems, compounded interest rates, for example, for thousands of years before the actual invention of coinage.
And so what accounts for the shifts then between these periods of credit money and those where gold and silver bullion may be used as money?
It's a really interesting question, and it's not entirely clear. There certainly is a pattern. You can see that coins are invented, as I say, almost simultaneously across Eurasia. It has something to do with the rise of a new type of professional armies that hadn't really existed before, so that coinage eventually becomes systematized as a way of paying soldiers. When the empires fall, the coins vanish. But I think it's more complicated than that. I mean, in the beginning of the Middle Ages, the gold and silver tends to get locked up in temples and monasteries again, and people go back to credit systems. For example, in the Middle East, already in Basra in 1000 AD, people are using checks for everyday transactions. Check is actually an Arab word. Paper money comes out of credit instruments in China around the same time. In Europe, they're using notched sticks that are broken in half called tally sticks. Why do they go back to virtual money? It's not entirely clear, but it has something to do with the rise of religious movements, which are, when they first arise, really anti-war movements. Coins are caught up in the system of professional soldiers, but also of chattel slavery. The armies are taking the slaves, putting them in the mines where they produce more gold and silver to pay the soldiers. It becomes this kind of great loop. Military coinage system. I would call it the military coinage slavery system. Somehow, in the Middle Ages, chattel slavery largely disappears in their pockets here and there, but for the most part, it's wiped out. And you have to bear in mind that 40% of the population, say, of Roman Italy, appears to have been actual chattel slaves. Several hundred years later, nobody's a slave. And, you know, in a way, it's one of the great liberations of human history, even though we think of it as the coin and ball of the Roman Empire, as a series of disasters. And it's an interesting paradigm, I think, for how historical shifts happen. We don't know. These anti-war movements then become religions that are adopted by the empires, in each case, in China, India, and Europe, with varying degrees of success. But in that process, somehow the militarism dies down, the armies are disbanded, the slaves are largely liberated to one degree or another. So I think there was some kind of broad social movement that we don't really completely understand. Then, even more complicated, what happens around 1492, when, of course, gold and silver come back again. People get the idea that money really is gold and silver again, rather than credit relations. And large empires reappear. Chattel slavery reappears, of course. It's a period that's really only ending now, since 1971, when Nixon goes off the gold standard. It's like a cutoff point. You have to choose one. Now, how did that happen? It's not entirely clear. In some ways, I think there's a lot of great historical ironies, because one of the things that sets off the whole thing is popular movements in China against the credit system, which is used by the government in various oppressive ways. People start create this kind of free market populism based on the use of silver, which is uncoined. It's coming out of these illegal silver mines. They create an alternative economy, and eventually the government gives in and says, okay, fine, we'll give up on the old caste system. We'll just create a new tax system where everybody has to pay in silver. And the problem is there wasn't much silver in China. They clean out all the mines pretty quickly. They clean out Japan in about 20, 30 years. And there's this huge thirst for silver in China. And most people don't realize this. What made the Spanish and Portuguese conquests in the New World actually economically viable is Europe, flush full of gold and silver, they didn't really know what to do with it. But there was this endless market for it in the East. So almost all the silver that the conquistadors take out of the Americas ends up in China. This starts a gradual shift back towards a metal-based economy.
David, you were talking about this shift in the modern era, approximately around 1450, where there was a turn away once again from virtual currencies and credit economies back to gold and silver. And as you say, this was an era of empire. Is there anything else that you would say characterizes this time, which is significant because what you're arguing is it came to an end about 40 years ago?
The central banking system that we have today, now it seems a rather innocuous thing, the Fed, the Bank of England, these are institutions which are, you know, charged with being fighting inflation and maintaining employment, ostensibly. But if you look at their actual origins, they all go back to that alliance between quasi-independent, politically independent financial class, or not just financial, but often industrial as well, basically the capitalists, and militarists. This is something that Marx really didn't talk about very much, and is left out of most standard accounts of what capitalism is. The money that's actually used by capitalists with each other generally is government war debt, and the central banks sort of way of channeling that. The story of how the Bank of England was created, it wasn't the first, it was the second actual central bank, but it became the paradigm for the model that exists in all countries in the world nowadays, is really telling. Essentially, the way it worked, a group of merchants got together and made a loan of £1.2 million to King William, who was fighting a war in France. What he did was, he said, all right, in exchange for this extremely large loan, I will give you a monopoly. You can call yourselves the Bank of England, and you have the right to take the money that I now owe you and to lend it to other people in the form of banknotes. Now, that's what British currency actually is. It still is. It's issued by the Bank of England, and it is a promissory note. If you look on a British bill, I actually have one in my pocket here because I live much of the time in London, here's a £10 note. You have a picture of the Queen right here, and above her head it says in very small letters, I promise to pay the bearer the sum of £10. That's what paper money is. It is a promise by the sovereign to pay what is ultimately a war debt. So it's circulating government debt. If the Queen ever actually did pay back the original loan, the currency system would disappear. Now, that system remains in place. I mean, if you look at the way that the Federal Reserve works, there's a lot more smoke and mirrors, but ultimately it's the same system. The difference is the British merchants in 1694 actually lent the money to, like, silver, gold to the king. It was gold, actually.